This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, our guest is a founder of an electric airplane company with a strong vision for the future. In the news, we have an update on the fatal Icon A5 crash, and we discuss the disruptive nature of electric and autonomous vehicles, as well as the Airbus Fly Your Ideas contest. We have some observations from the Wings Over Pittsburgh Air Show. We talk about the Aerospace Media Dinner and Awards. And we give some advice to listeners asking about a flying career. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 453 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by first Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a CFI, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody, and it's nice to be back. I did survive my daughter's college graduation, although it was a little iffy at times, but it's nice to be here.
She got the paper, though, right?
Yeah, she did, actually.
All right, that's all that counts. All right, also joining us is the other Max. That's Max Trescott. He's a CFI as well, an author, glass cockpit expert, and he hosts the Aviation News Talk podcast. Hey, Max.
Well, hello, Max, and co-hosts and listeners around the world. It's nice to be back. You guys all went off to Pittsburgh last weekend, and I didn't, so it's nice to catch up with you again here.
That's right. We're going to talk about some of our observations, some of our impressions from the Pittsburgh Air Show coming up in a bit. But we have with us Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Max. Hello, everyone. Yeah, Rob, Max West. Sorry you couldn't make it out to Pittsburgh. You guys were definitely missed. It was a really, really fun event.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian. He blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hello, everyone. Yes, Brian was right. It was a very good show and worth the 6-hour drive both ways. But and I'm sure Max will attest to that also. But looking forward to going back to old school recording on a Monday night.
Here we are.
Now, just don't tell us it was uphill both ways to Pittsburgh, because I've driven the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
It is uphill both ways. I tell you, it's true what they say.
Okay.
All right. Our guest this episode is Matt Knapp. He's a founder at Zunum Aero and the Aero Chief Engineer. You'll recall that Zunum was recently in the news after JetBlue and Boeing's Horizon X division invested in the company. We talked about that back in episode 447. Well, Matt started his passion for aviation, actually, the way I did, building model rockets and model airplanes. Except I was about 10, and he started at about age 5. He got his pilot's license at 17, went on to earn his BS and MS in aerospace engineering at MIT. Before founding Zunum Aero, he was the lead designer for the Javelin high-performance jet and lead aerodynamicist for Pioneer rocket planes spacecraft. Matt has consulted for major aircraft OEMs, NASA, DARPA, and he's a CFI. Matt, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Max. It's nice to be here.
Now, on the Zunum webpage, it mentions a phrase, democratizing access to high-speed travel. Can you just quickly tell us, what does that mean?
Sure. Well, you guys gave me a great opening there. The purpose of Zunum, if we've done our job right, you will not need to drive the 6 hours on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, because we will open up regional high-speed connectivity, not to the 1% or even 2%, but at the cost point that normal people can travel at. So that's what we mean by democratizing, bringing high-speed regional connectivity to the people traveling on a normal budget.
All right. We're going to talk about that a lot coming up. It's very exciting. I love these kinds of major shifts in the way transportation operates. We've been seeing quite a few of them, and we'll talk about some of them in the news, actually. But why don't we get started right away with the news segment? Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
We have an article from Flying Magazine. This is NTSB releases preliminary Icon accident report. This, of course, is concerning the fatal Icon A5 crash that recently occurred. Now, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB preliminary report, it really centers around the account of a witness who was, I guess, on a boat at the same lake where the Icon A5 went down. Max T, this is a lake that you've mentioned in the past that you've flown into that lake, haven't you?
Sure. Lake Berryessa is one of the better places to go take a seaplane. Here in Northern California, it's nice and long. It's sheltered by hills on both sides, so that keeps the wind at the surface pretty low. There's some really, really large landing areas available in the northern two-thirds of the lake. This particular report didn't seem to add a whole lot to what came out in the news prior to the release of the report. The key thing that kind of stands out to me is that they were in a pretty narrow, tight part of the lake where I certainly wouldn't have been down, you know, close to the water. It's hard to know what they were doing, but it wasn't where most people will be landing seaplanes. That's all I can say.
Now, according to this article, the witness saw the Icon flying about 30 to 50 feet above the water into a cove, a nearby cove, Little Portuguese Canyon. And the quote is, the witness heard the engine rev up as the airplane drifted to the right side of the cove, and then the airplane pitched upward and entered a left turn just before it traveled beyond the witness field of view. And then a sound of impact was heard shortly after losing visual sight of the airplane. Rob, it kind of still remains a bit of a mystery in terms of what actually happened here. I guess we've got a lot more investigating to go.
Well, there's always going to be more investigating. I think, you know, certainly the witness that saw everything short of the impact gives you a pretty good idea of what was going on. I mean, that if this airplane had been – now, Max T, you know that area way better than I do. So, I mean, if that airplane had been at 100 feet instead of down as low as it would have been, would that still have been too low if they turned up one of those harbors?
Yeah, that could have made all the difference. I mean, there are lots of little nooks and crannies, but all of them are pretty narrow down at that end of the lake. So it's not a great place to be landing or taking off. And it's if you look at the state's seaplane landing area for that particular lake, there are designated landing areas, and they're all considerably north of there. So to me, it's just not a great place to be low. It kind of smacks of pilot error, but obviously there's no way to know at this point.
Yeah.
Well, what they do know is that the company put, you know, they initially grounded all the airplanes, and within a short span of time, put them all back in the air. So I mean, that tells me that someone spent enough time at the company to kind of look at the airplane and say, do we have a major mechanical or aerodynamic failure somewhere? And that didn't appear to be the case. And because otherwise I doubt they would have just put the airplane back on flying status. But I think what was really telling was it was such a sad picture to watch this little airplane broken in pieces laying on the shore. I know that since that was a flying story, I had been going through the comments that people leave, and I think the initial person that read the story said something like, it didn't look really good that there was a witness right up until almost the impact, and people really came down on him and said, well, you don't know what was really going on, and you can't speculate, and it's not fair. You shouldn't be doing it. Yeah, you're right. And, you know, we've had that discussion hundreds of times on this show, I think. And I don't think there's anything wrong, though, with having experts in an area put two and two together for what they do know and saying, well, it could have been this or it could have been that. We don't know finally, but it's just frightening to think that somebody would have been out doing something that low to the water and possibly put themselves in a situation where they couldn't escape.
Yeah. Being low to the water isn't a problem per se, but being in really narrow confines that are heavily forested close to the water, that's an issue.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, certainly we'll follow the investigation as it proceeds and unfolds. Meantime, we have an article. This is from oilprice.com. Now, they call themselves a source for oil and energy news. And that's not usually a publication that we quote from or find aviation stories in. But this one is called Disruptive Tech. Electric airplanes could destroy the automotive industry. Now, what they're doing here in this article is reporting on a new study by a research group and think tank called RethinkX. And they say on their website, and I'll quote the ThinkX website, "We are on the cusp of the fastest, deepest, most consequential disruption of transportation in history. By 2030, within 10 years of regulatory approval of autonomous vehicles," now get this, 95% of U.S. passenger miles traveled will be served by on-demand autonomous electric vehicles owned by fleets, not individuals, in a new business model we call Transport as a Service, or TAAS. Remember that one. I think we're going to be hearing Transport as a Service in the future in many different contexts. But the oilprice.com article points to the Uber electric airplane is sort of an example of this. Uber recently had this Elevate conference in Dallas, and there was a lot of activity, a lot of interest in this electric autonomous or self-directed airplane to provide the kinds of services that you would expect from Uber. We'll have a report. We'll have a link to the report in the show notes, the RethinkX report itself, if you want to peruse that in some detail. But it raises some interesting issues concerning electric aircraft and autonomous aircraft and that sort of thing. What do you guys think? Do you think we're on the cusp of this major disruption to the transportation industry?
I'd say probably. I think there's been enough talk about electrically powered aircraft that it's certainly going to be something to watch. Whether it happens as quickly as these people are predicting, I don't know, it's another story. But I mean, replacing cars, think about that. That sounds pretty exciting. Of course, unless you're in the oil business, then it's probably not quite as exciting. But you know, think about, I don't know, how many cars do we have in this country? A couple hundred million? I doubt seriously they're all going to go away and there are suddenly going to be a couple hundred million of these little airplanes, little electric machines out there scooting around like they were in, oh gosh, what was that, that movie with Harrison Ford,
The Witness,
Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. Thank you, Runner. David. So I doubt very much it's going to be like Blade Runner where they're running in nine directions at the same moment, but because that's going to create another problem of its own. But yeah, I think it's probably coming. I think there's enough creativity in the world and enough need to try to get rid of fossil fuel driven vehicles. But, you know, again, I probably not going to happen as quickly as they say, at least I don't think.
Could somebody call 911, please? Because I'm about to have a heart attack.
Okay.
Rob Mark,
David, what's
up? Is talking about electric airplanes and unmanned piloted electric airplanes for passengers in a positive manner. My, how far has he fallen?
Well,
I don't want it to go through my windshield.
I or my didn't windscreen. Say I believed in everything they were doing, but like I said, I'd never, come on, we're going to make Matt think we're all crazy. I mean, I've never been a positive guy about, or a negative guy about drones. I just don't think they have the keeping drones and airplanes separated from each other part figured out. And that's what bothers me. So same thing. I mean, I'm talking about all these electric airplanes, that's fine. You get them to work, great, go for it, man. Just tell me how you're going to keep them apart. That's the big math problem, I think.
Yeah, I think a fleet of Uber taxis, if you will, air taxis, if you will, it represents the same issues, the same, you know, how do you manage the airspace issues when we talk about drones. And because, I mean, they're essentially a large drone. But the system isn't really, as it stands today, isn't really meant to handle that kind of volume or, you know, fleets of these things flying around. So the tough problem that people have been talking about for drones is sort of magnified when you start talking about adding in a whole nother, you know, layer of aircraft flying in the skies.
Oh, absolutely. And I bet you our guest is going to have a thought about that. But I don't, Matt, do you have a thought about it now or should we?
Sure. I was debating whether I'd jump in here. Little heads up on Zunum. We're developing a much more conventional aircraft. We're looking at regional travel and something more the size of a PC-12 would be our market entry point. We're not looking at VTOL initially. We're looking at a conventional takeoff flown by a normal pilot. And we've done that because that's a big market that we think is not being well served today. And so these autonomous drones are certainly getting an awful lot of press, a lot of buzz, and I expect them to make a lot of buzz when they're taking off and landing.
That was good. That was good.
That was good. The two drone guys like that one.
And they certainly have a market, you know, in the intra-regional or intra-urban, really, you know, it's less than 30 miles. And we're targeting the 100 to 500, 700 mile range, which is a more substantial distance, but a distance that is very poorly served by the airlines right now. So that's not really a good comment on the story, but more letting you know where I'm going to be talking from.
Yeah, and that makes sense because what you're doing, Matt, or what you're working towards is, it sounds like, I think, is consistent with the way air traffic is managed now. It's not really introducing any new issues for the infrastructure that's in place. Is that the way to look at this?
Yes. When we started looking at the market space, we said, you know, certifying new things is a challenge, and how many challenges do you want to take on at once? And we said we're going to go with hybrid electric propulsion as a major challenge. And the fastest way to market then is to come up with an airplane that fits into the existing airspace with existing pilots flying to existing airports and flying existing routes where there's a known demonstrated strong demand for travel, which is currently not being met.
Let me throw out one other thing on this particular story. I had a question come in from an engineering student a couple of weeks ago on Aviation News Talk, and he asked about whether flying cars were, you know, going to be real. And I kind of commented that, you know, I think that this is kind of a different concept from what we've always thought about as the Jetsons, you know, flying car. And I think that the reality of, you know, small piloted electric vehicles is probably going to be a lot closer to, you know, semi-autonomous pilotless drones than somebody who has their personal flying car that they, you know, park in their garage. Matt's right about the buzz. I just can't imagine having to listen to that, you know, in the neighborhood every day as people would, you know, take off from, you know, their local you know, neighborhood. So I think that we are actually getting to the point where we do have technologies that will make sense and that we will actually, you know, see out there. I think the flying cars, you know, people have been working on that for 60 plus years, and I don't think that's going to be it. I don't think we're going to be able to have large numbers of people get pilot licenses and fly conventional type aircraft that are also cars sufficiently well. But if you can end up with something that's fairly automated, perhaps pilotless, that's actually a concept that I think will work.
Well, I think if we could look ahead to maybe 20 years, I'll say 20 years. Some people say or hope maybe that it's a lot less than that, but I'll say 20 years into the future, I think things will probably be a lot different than they are now. It's just hard for me to imagine or predict just what they will look like.
Hey, Max, that's a problem that I had with the story is 20 years out is not on the cusp. Right. It's a little bit further out than I been in high tech my entire career. On the cusp is what's coming out in the next week to 6 months.
Let's level set on aviation here. I learned to fly in a Cessna 150 in 1987. And I teach students in the same 150 now in 2017. So for us, the next 20 years of massive change to the aircraft industry is really on the cusp.
And from an automotive standpoint, you know, the automobile's been around for 100 years or so. You know, 20 years to get a major breakthrough or change, it doesn't seem that long when you figure how long people have been driving the same four-wheeled vehicles.
All right. Well, we'll invite all of you listening, if you have some thoughts on this, where do you think this is going to go? Is are we on the cusp? Or are we getting ready to see a major disruption in the way transportation works in this country? Let us know your thoughts. You can write us at thegeeks at airplanegeeks.com. Meanwhile, one more story we wanted to mention. It's kind of a follow-up. This is actually from Marissa Garcia's Flight Chick blog. Winner of Airbus's Fly Your Ideas competition solves underseat crunch. Now, you might recall that Airbus has run this contest, Fly Your Ideas, and teams of students get together on projects and make proposals. And the winner this time around came from the University of Hong Kong in the Airbus Fly Your Ideas contest. And their idea is to create sort of a storage space under your feet, under the seat in front of you on an airliner. And what they envision here is a compartment that actually is below the floor level of the cabin, extends into the upper part of the cargo area. And this will be a place where you can store some of your carry-on items. I think that's it's kind of a creative idea. It's always an interesting idea to see how these students come up with some really kind of creative, innovative ideas.
I like it. I mean, there's a piece of real estate that's not necessarily being used in the airplane. You have to change the structure of the floor somewhat to be able to support that. But what a clever idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the others from the Airbus website, and we'll put a link to that website in the show notes. It hasn't been fully updated, I don't think, since the winner was announced, but there's some other teams in there. University of Surrey in the UK, they had a concept that turns a commercial airliner into an Earth observation device. Nevada, this actually from a university in Nigeria. This was for an airport taxiing system, says uses sensors and algorithms to significantly improve aircraft traffic at airports and thus reduce emissions. And there's a number of other interesting teams that were in the finalists for this contest. So, yeah, I think it's great that Airbus does this. I think it's a great way to get students involved in aviation and trying to develop some new concepts. So congratulations to the winners and also the others who participated in this.
A good way to find some future interns to work at the company as well.
All right, let's move on to our main topic. Again, we're speaking with Matt Knapp. He's a Zunum Aero founder. Also, is that your title, Matt, Chief or Aero Chief Engineer?
Yeah, you know, people keep asking us for titles, and we like to stick with just plain founder, and I sometimes put down Aero Chief Engineer so people know that I'm the airplane designer side of the founding team. We are a small organization and moving fast and nimble, and everybody does a bit of everything. And really, I'm just the founder and an airplane designer.
Can you tell us maybe just briefly a little bit about the other founders, the other members of sort of the leadership team? What kinds of people are making up this company?
Sure. So there's two of us co-founders. We've been working on this for almost 4 years now. Ashish Kumar, my primary co-founder, has a very strong technical background, actually has a PhD in aero structures. And then he went the business route and went through McKinsey and then spent some time on the business side in large corporations such as Dell, Google, and Microsoft, and was looking for a new challenge and something to really pick up. And as a business person, when I came to him with this idea, he saw the financial side of it that, you know, myself as the engineer was kind of hinting at, but really couldn't get to. So it's been a fantastic collaboration between the two of us, driving this idea from what started as a kind of a what-if engineering exercise into a really plausible market case, and we think a very viable company. In addition to us, the founders, we've spent a fair bit of time assembling a really high-power technical board to guide our early development and, you know, our later development as well. So we're developing core technologies in primarily in propulsion and hybrid electric powertrains. So we have one of the folks who is working on the Makani kite. That's the wind generation kite. We have Oliver Masefield as an advisor, and he is the chief engineer, recently retired chief engineer of the PC-24. We have Jayant Sabnis, who's a recently retired VP of Pratt & Whitney and now a senior lecturer at MIT, guiding us on the propulsion side of things. And a number of other folks who we've engaged with over the years on propulsion, on batteries, on powertrain, to build a world-class team so that we can bring this fantastic idea to market.
When you were assembling the team, or as the team was coming together, did you have to convince these other people of the viability of this, or did they just come running and screaming and saying, you know, I want to be on this team?
There is certainly some skepticism, and especially 4 years ago, you know, when we first started, there was much less industry acceptance. I think we really turned a corner in the industry about a year ago, and you know, I'm in the technical circles with AIAA, the American Institute of Aviation Aeronautics, and the technical conferences. And this has gone from being a very small niche of people playing with NASA money to suddenly an area of great interest. So you know, 4 years ago, it was a much different conversation. And then as the plausibility and the Tesla, we can really thank Tesla for showing people that electric vehicles can be high power and fast and high performance all at the same time. And electric doesn't mean something that's kind of slow and pokey. And these are also very, very smart people. So it really didn't take long. I would say half an hour of sitting down with some numbers and some first principles back calculation on the back of the envelope by these guys to say, wow, you're right. This is something absolutely really impressive. And this is going to happen. And it may, you know, your timing may be off, like you said. It may be a few years earlier, a few years later. But this is a really impressive shift that is going to rock the industry over the next, you know, 50, 100 years. And really, we see the jet engine has shaped, fundamentally shaped transportation for about 70 years now. And we see electric propulsion emerging to reshape aviation, not in the same way, but with a similar magnitude of impact. And initially in the regional sector and in the intra-urban sector, and eventually extending to much further ranges as the energy storage technology and capability catches up with some of the amazing progress we've had in high-power motors, converters, and the other components of that propulsion system.
Now, the technology of the batteries seems to be a big driver in kind of all of these, you know, electric transportation projects. And I guess we've seen energy density increasing over time. But where do you see the technology now? Are we where we need to be with battery technology, or do we need more development? I know Tesla, as you mentioned, is viewing this as kind of a path that they're on of, you know, increasing improvements. Where do you think we are in that journey?
Sure. Well, as where we think we are, we specify that very precisely in a watt hour per kilogram term. And that's around 320 watt hours per kilogram at the cell level, meaning a raw battery cell sitting there on the lab bench. And compared to Jet A, that's not fantastic. But when we started running the calculations for a hybrid operating commercially over a regional distance, and we found that we could operate really successfully with anything over about 300 watt hours per kilogram. So we're already the batteries that we need for Zunum to be close our business case are already here, which means that we as the airplane maker are about 5 years behind battery technology. Now, for folks who are going all electric right away and who have the additional demands of a vertical takeoff, which, of course, is a very high power spike, power draw for the takeoff and landing, that's a bit of a tougher proposition. And, you know, they're just going to have shorter range. And with a vertical takeoff and landing, I guess you can have pretty short range. And all of us are going to see just, you know, improving performance, improving costs as the batteries continue to improve over time. That's really been a challenge and an area where we have led, which is to develop an airplane that is good for the batteries today, but also the batteries in 10 years, 20 years. Airframes tend to fly for 20, 25 years. So that's been an exciting part of this challenge, is that we've got a moving target in terms of what the energy sources on the airplane look like, depending on when in the airplane's life we're calculating its performance.
Now, you've mentioned a hybrid electric a couple of times. What's the hybrid part of that power system?
Sure. So what we are developing is what we call a range-optimized powertrain. And in fact, it's a range-optimized transportation system. And by that, we mean that we design the propulsion and the airframe to fly at speeds and ranges appropriate for the market we're trying to fill. So for regional, that's really 100 to 500 and out to even 700 or 800 miles. And we can do that with a hybrid system in the early 2020s. And the hybrid part of that is most likely going to be a gas turbine. We could even start with something as humdrum as an off-the-shelf PT6A off the nose of a Caravan, for example. And we use that entirely for generating electricity. So we've got substantial batteries in the wings. We've got this generator. And then what we're developing is the logic and the flight path optimization and the energy sourcing algorithms that get you the most efficient flight in terms of when you pull from the batteries, when you pull from the generation, to get the lowest total cost and best speed range over that particular flight profile.
So in general, are you looking at using gas when you're in the high power regions, for example, climb and things like that, and then batteries when you're straight and level?
It depends substantially on how far you are going. If you're going to do a quick island flight, for example, Seattle to the San Juans is 70 miles. You know, when you talk to Cape Air out there on the East Coast, a lot of their routes are 30 to 60, 90 miles. Those flights could be entirely electric from the moment this airplane rolls out the door. And the generator would be sitting there as your reserve, your IFR reserve requirement, even though you never actually turned it on that flight.
And then for recharging the battery, is that going to be done strictly internally with the turbine engine?
No, actually, we charge from the grid. So it's a plug-in series hybrid, which the best automotive corollary, I think, is the Chevy Volt, where you have about 50 or 60 miles of pure battery range. If you drive more than that in the Volt, then the engine kicks in and helps you along, but it doesn't really charge the battery. In our case, because in an airplane, you typically know where you are, where you're going, what the winds aloft are doing, we can tailor that energy profile from start to finish. So maybe the generator will come on at takeoff, take the load down on your batteries a bit, stay on through climb, partway through climb or partway through cruise. When the computer says you've got enough stored energy on board to make your destination, the generation will turn itself off. And if you're doing it, you're out to your maximum range, that generation would pretty much run to the top of descent, and then it would switch off when you hit that low energy descent phase of flight.
Yeah, what kind of speeds would you have compared to a PC-12 if that's kind of what you're most equivalent to?
So we don't typically talk about a fixed speed. And again, it's all part of the range optimization. What market are we designing for? PC-12 speeds are pretty good for that 300 to 500 mile market.
And Matt, why are you not recharging the battery in flight? Is it the weight penalty that you would experience by having this additional equipment on board?
Well, it's all a matter of what's your most efficient way to bring energy with you. The electric motor propulsion gives you a fantastically low-cost propulsion source. The generation is there to provide the gap between what batteries can do now and what batteries will eventually be able to do. The battery is the lowest cost source of energy as long as you charge it from the grid. So when you take off, your objective is to make sure that you use as much low-cost energy as you can. Charging those batteries in flight would mean you'd need a bigger gas turbine, and you'd be using that very expensive gas turbine to generate electricity, something that you can do much, much cheaper on the ground.
But, you know, maybe I missed this, but what type of batteries did you say we already have that could do the job? I mean, I guess I'm wondering, what are these lithium ion batteries or what?
Yeah, I'm just talking about the latest generation out of the Tesla Gigafactory, the 2170 cells that they've started producing.
Will that be your source for the cells? I know Tesla is, you know, people view them as an automobile company, but in many ways, they're really in the battery business. Will they be the source for you guys?
They could be a source. We cannot count on a dedicated source of batteries. Batteries are inordinately expensive to develop, and we in aviation are the beneficiaries of huge amounts of investment from outside sources going into battery technology, from the government, from Tesla. Tens of billions of dollars at this point have gone into batteries. So our challenge is to be able to use those batteries that are available at huge economies of scale. So we will source from whatever is the most appropriate source, whether that is Tesla or LG or another one of these automotive suppliers who are going to be just churning out gigawatt hours worth of batteries. And, you know, lithium ion is where the technology is now. We have a forecast for the various players and various emerging chemistries. There's lots and lots of very exciting announcements about breakthroughs in batteries, which you need to remember that it takes about 10 or 15 years to go from a lab bench to a high-rate commercial production. But we've got 20 years of this airplane flying around. So we fully expect to see some of those breakthrough chemistries coming out, possibly even in the early 2020s.
Now, this is going to amuse David, but this question is, but are fuel cells do they have a possible role in this, or do you think stored energy batteries are the way to go?
You had to go there, didn't you?
Yeah, I knew he was going to say
that. The fuel cell we would actually use in place of the gas turbine. And if you look at a fuel cell car, it's almost always a hybrid because a fuel cell does not have a very fast response. So they've always got a battery, which is there for the shorter transients, the acceleration and the regenerative braking and that sort of thing. And we would do the same thing. We would replace the gas turbine with a fuel cell. The weight of the fuel cell stack has gotten much more competitive. We're talking about the PEM fuel cells, for example, which Toyota and Honda have spent lots and lots of research money developing. A challenge with that is that hydrogen, of course, is a little bit on the bulky side. And the other challenge is that there's not a good infrastructure in place for hydrogen right now.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly not ruling it out. We are developing a modular system, and if fuel cell is a winning technology, then we would be happy to pick it up and run with it or fly with it.
Interesting.
What would you say is the biggest challenge you have ahead of you, say, maybe in the next 12 to 18 months, Matt?
So we are focusing on the long lead items, and some of our challenges are regulatory and some of them are technology. We're focusing on building ground-based prototypes, and then we'll be moving on to a flying testbed prototype where we take our powertrain and put it on an existing aircraft and fly that around and start getting flight test experience. The ducted fan propulsor it leverages heavily the conventional bypass fan technology, but it does operate kind of in a corner of the envelope that they're not that familiar with in designing in terms of the lower speeds, lower pressure ratios. So that's one of our major development areas. And then we've been working very closely with the FAA, who is watching this groundswell. And the FAA we've had good communications with them for a couple of years now, and we're actually ramping that up to a more frequent interaction as we prepare for our path to being able to file a type certificate in this very new class of aircraft.
From the photo on your website, it shows a V-tail, which would be the same configuration as the Cirrus Vision Jet that just came out. Now, they've got a single engine on top of the fuselage. Is the V-tail advantageous to you, even though you've got multiple engines and they're not mounted on top?
Yes. Actually, I may end up putting the generator between the V-tails on top, which is actually what we show on the 40 seat or the larger airplane. So the 10-seat concept, we've envisioned that the generation could be a turbo diesel, it could be a gas turbine. And we're designing for a modular type concept there. In terms of the VTOL, one aspect I was looking at is, absolutely let's reduce the amount of empennage weight and drag as we can. By keeping those ducted fans close to centerline, my adverse yaw in terms of an engine out type scenario is reduced, which makes the V-tail more practical. And the other thing it does is it gets the tail up out of the wake from the fans so that I can keep a laminar flow on the tail. So it's an engineering decision, which is also somewhat stylistic. And it's got some nice synergies with the way that we've developed the propulsion system.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the V-tail looks nice too.
One of the announcements from a couple, I guess it was last month actually, said that you guys had gotten a chunk of investment money from Boeing and from JetBlue. And so, Boeing, of all people, you would think would be the people saying, oh my gosh, we're just trying to figure out how to build 737 Maxes faster. But do you think that the people at the high end airliner type manufacturing, do they get this, do you think? Or are they just saying, well, let's just dump some money in there and kind of keep an eye on what these guys are doing?
Well, I'd like to start by clarifying a little bit. The investment has come from JetBlue Technology Ventures, which is a independent LLC subsidiary. I mean, they are funded by JetBlue as the parent company, but they are an independent subsidiary. So it's not a direct investment by the airline. It's through their technology venture arm. And the same for Boeing. It's Boeing Horizon X, which, again, is an independent subsidiary of Boeing. So our investors in particular like us to make sure that we make that distinction. So with that formality out of the way. These have been fantastic investors to have, and the reason for that is they understand the space, and they have an interest in seeing the space develop. JetBlue is one of the more innovative airlines out there, and they are always looking for markets they can serve, and right now they would love to serve more regional travel. They develop their business serving point to point. They would like to serve points that are closer together. And with the current airline consolidation around 737s, that's very difficult to do. JetBlue would love to serve more regional markets. And as JetBlue Technology Ventures was looking for ways, innovative ways to foster development in the space, that was a great partnership to have. Boeing has seen that this is an area of potential. Now, what's interesting is that a lot of the development going on, a lot of what we work on is propulsion. So that while we look like an airframer, if you look more closely, we look like an engine manufacturer. But what's happening in the space is that propulsion and airframe are getting closer and closer and more integrated. And so Boeing is also eyeing that type of relationship and how that might shape the future of how the airframer and the engine maker are more closely intertwined. So they're very interested in the technology. They're very interested to see where it goes. And they're very interested in being on the front line there.
Hmm. That's an extremely interesting point and very forward-looking, I think. Matt, how do you envision the aircraft coming together? Is this something that you think eventually Zunim will build, or assembled by Zunim, or contracted out? What kind of manufacturing relationship do you think you'll have in the future?
We have a couple of plans, and from the beginning, we planned to be a full-stack manufacturer because as an entrepreneurial startup company, we could not go out to an investor and say, hey, we're going to develop this fantastic propulsion system and hope that somebody shows up and wants to buy it with an airframe. So we have maintained a strong in-house aircraft preliminary design capability and continue to do that. But at the same time, we are actively talking with potential airframe partners because standing up a brand new airframe manufacturing capability is a very expensive proposition.
Sure.
There are quite a few companies around the planet in this country and many others who would be capable of manufacturing large parts of the airframe that we could partner with and help them understand how to optimize the airframe for the hybrid electric propulsion. And of course, we would be the provider of that propulsion system.
Hmm. Very cool. And tell us, Matt, what's the timeline?
So our timeline, as I talked about a little bit with the prototypes, we are working on a ground-based prototype right now, non-flight hardware, but a full size. You know, it's what we call in the industry, we call a copper bird. It's a representative size, layout, power levels all on the ground. Over the next 2 years, we progressively upgrade that system and go install it partially onto a flying test bed. This would be something like a Rockwell Aero Commander, the C-90. We replace one of those gas turbines with one of our electric motors. We'd have most of the rest of the powertrain just there in the fuselage, so easy access for upgrading, improving, and working on. After that, we should be at that point in a committed relationship with one or more airframers partners, and moving towards we think the first conforming articles would be around 2020. Mid to late 2020, with a target of having the first aircraft hitting the market in late 2022.
Matt, the artist rendition that you have of the aircraft on your website is certainly a beautiful aircraft. One of the things that I noticed is the straight wing versus a swept wing. Can you talk about the decision behind that?
Sure. I mean, that's part of the range optimizing, which is, if you're going to fly 500, 700, even out to 1,000 miles, the real bottlenecks in the current system are not the speed of the aircraft. Flying Mach 0.72 versus 0.78 or even 8.2 over 800 or 1,000 miles does not save you that much time, but it burns you a heck of a lot of gas and it makes for a much heavier wing. So if you are really optimizing an aircraft to deliver a really efficient, energy efficient, cost efficient regional transportation network, then there is no reason to design an airplane which also flies just as well out to 3,000 plus miles, which is what every 37 and A320 does right now.
Hmm. Well, Matt, I can imagine several things. One is you're probably really, really, really busy. Probably you're having the time of your life. Do you have time to do any flying yourself these days?
My flying has been pretty poor lately. I am a CFI. I keep that current. I did have a student up through about 6 or 8 months ago. And then as this is really ramped up, I'm staying current, but not doing a whole lot more than that. Now, we just went through the wettest winter on record in Seattle. So that certainly didn't help either. And now that the days are going to be light until 10 o'clock at night and the weather is gorgeous, then I'll just have to make a little bit more time to get up in the air.
All right. Well, we won't hold it against you because obviously when you're working so hard in a startup kind of environment, it really is a 20-hour workday for most people for most days. So I hope you're enjoying life along the way as well. And we want to thank you for coming on the show. We'll certainly be following along. Hope you'll stay in touch. And best of luck on this really, really exciting project.
All right. So I just like to close with saying, we're really excited to see the future of aviation to transform over the coming decades and really excited to be part of it. And we think that what we're offering is the ability to get you off the Pittsburgh Turnpike, Pennsylvania Turnpike, and cut those door-to-door travel times, by 2 to 4 times at much lower cost than you could serve those routes right now today. And so that's our democratizing travel. We see better regional connectivity, restoring some of these connections to communities that have lost service. All these things are fantastic opportunities, and we're really excited to be a part of it.
Great. Tell us where we can find Zunum online and any other resources or places you might point us to.
The best place, the central place, is our website, which is zunum.aero, zunum.aero. And from there, we have links to social media, conventional press releases and that sort of thing.
Great. All right, Matt, thanks again.
All right. Well, thank you all for having me on the show.
One thing before you go, what does Zunum mean?
So Zunum is the phoneticized word, Mayan word for hummingbird. And it's spelled several different ways, but it's pronounced Zunum. And I just really like the word. We have looked at vertical takeoff. It might be more appropriate for some of the VTOL companies. But I like the word, and we hold on to VTOL as an opportunity, a growth direction for us at some point. So that's where that comes from.
And that's why the little logo is a stylized hummingbird.
It is. That's a great logo. A friend of mine, Ray Castle, came up with that about 4 years ago now, and it's served us very well. We like it. Zunum is hummingbirds are recognized as fantastic flyers, so you know we like it.
Yeah. Yep. That's really awesome.
Definitely fits.
Yes. I'm curious. Have you talked to folks like Surf Air, which has a large fleet of PC-12s? Is this something? It seems like this would fit perfectly with their business model.
We have talked to a couple investors at Surf Air. We've talked to a number of regional carriers. Like you said, there is the new model, and that is probably the area of fastest growth is the Surf Airs. And we certainly keep our eyes on that kind of opportunity along with the more traditional carriers such as Cape Air, cargo folks. We go out and talk to the carriers on a regular basis.
All right, good. Excellent. Can you stick with us, Matt?
You know, unfortunately, being that startup founder that I am, I think I will duck off at this point.
Okay, no problems, no problems.
Thanks for your time. This has really been excellent.
Yeah, all right, cool.
Yeah, very cool. All right, Matt, thank you.
Well, thank you all.
All right.
Thank you so much, Matt.
All right.
Yeah. Really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Wow.
This is going to be really interesting to follow along.
Yeah, this to
me especially – oh, go ahead, Max.
No,
I'm sorry.
Right.
I was going to say, especially when you consider that over the last 25 years, how many times you've heard airlines saying, well, we have to pull out of Poughkeepsie because we can't afford to run a 737 or an Airbus in and out of that town – carrying 30 people. We can't make any money doing that. And imagine what this could mean for the industry. Wow.
Well, and they've been phasing out the RJs, moving back to kind of 90 seaters, getting rid of all the 70s and 50s and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then eliminating all those cities.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
This would open up the bottom end again.
Yeah.
Plus, to me, just this seems more within reach than something like Ariane and Reno supersonic business jet. It's like, oh my God, how many of those are you going to sell and how many years is that out? But this really seems closer in, more doable, infect a lot more people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that really surprised me about this conversation, I was really skeptical coming into this. I just like having things there and working and just being available all the time. And to listen to him talk, especially about why they're not recharging the batteries in flight, for example, he really put me at ease over that, where I'd be comfortable going for a flight. Whereas before we started this show, I don't think I would have.
Interesting reaction.
Well, in PC-12, that opens up all kinds of little airports. You know, my little 2,500-foot airport has PC-12s coming in all day long. That means you could go into virtually any airport in America.
Yep, I guess those airplanes would need a pilot, wouldn't they? Yeah. Probably won't be drones, will they?
Yeah, it could even fly into Santa Monica with its reduced runway now.
Oh, please, let's not open up that can of worms.
All right. Hey, let's talk about the air show that some of us went to. So for those of you who aren't aware, the recently completed last weekend Wings Over Pittsburgh air show. David Vanderhoof, myself, Brian Coleman attended, but we also had the full crew basically from the airline pilot guy show, and also Carlos and Matt from Plane Talking UK were there, and it was just a really wonderful weekend. Brian, what did you think of the whole thing?
I thought it was great. Seeing all the people again, that was more important to me than the airplanes. And the airplanes were certainly great as well. We got some, I think, wonderful interviews out of the event. Watching the F-22 fly still leaves my jaw dropped. That is just an incredible aircraft.
I know you watch that thing maneuvering in the sky. And I mean, the F-16s from the Thunderbirds, great stuff. The the F-18 demonstration, amazing stuff. But when you see the F-22, it just you can't believe an airplane can move in the sky, in the air, the way that thing does. It's just amazing. David, what'd you think?
Sorry, I just woke out of a power outage. What did I miss?
That explains it.
That explains it. Oh, sorry to hear about it. David, what are your thoughts on the air show?
Pittsburgh. They had power. It was great. For me, and if you listen to the show that we did on Saturday night, it was kind of cathartic for me. It was kind of a homecoming. One of the jokes was that I knew everybody. The Skytypers were there, so I met the gang there at breakfast. But more importantly, it was sort of a homecoming for me. When I was a little kid, Dad would take me out to Pittsburgh because he'd have meetings out with their civil engineering staff. So the building that visitors officers quarters that we used to stay at and the engineering building were all sort of there. And the 9/11 was nice enough to put up 4 C-130s. So I was like a little kid again, sitting on the end of the runway, watching 4 C-130s taxi out and take off. So after losing my dad in March, it was kind of cathartic and it brought back some really good memories of growing up and how lucky I was. And then at night, dinners and laughter and gangs from Europe and Carlos and Matt and everybody, it was pretty awesome. It was lovely. Like always, you go for the airplanes, but you really stay around for the people. And it was nice meeting people that we've talked to over the internet and stuff, but it was pretty awesome.
And David, I'm not sure if you heard the story that I told where I was standing in line getting food and there was a gentleman with an Airplane Geeks t-shirt on and we just started talking and he said something to the effect of, gee, you're Brian from the Airplane Geeks. So it was really weird just being noticed as well. But, you know, just seeing our listeners was really, that bit was great.
Yeah, there were a lot of listeners, a lot of fans there. The big turnout for the live Airplane Pilot Guy show Friday night, that was Friday night, there were about 30 people there watching in the live audience, and that was great. And then on Saturday for the panel discussion that we had with the three aviation podcasts, there was a big crew for that as well, and some great times.
The extravaganza.
And there are links to the videos of those two recordings in last episode's show notes. So look for those if you haven't seen them already at airplanegeeks.com/452, last week's episode.
Yeah. And Max and I were joking. There's a reason why we don't do video. It was really awesome watching these guys set up video and doing the YouTube stuff. It's like, no, that's way too much work.
Yeah, yeah. They have a lot of equipment and gear. Interesting, you know, they rented a lot of gear because of the sort of the magnitude of this. And just to watch Matt and Neville operate all this equipment, yeah, David, I agree with you. Don't look for video from us anytime soon. That's for sure. We'll stick with audio. So great event. The 9/11 put on a fantastic show. A lot of great airplanes there. Huge turnout. We had a couple of different numbers from different people as to attendance. But kind of the most credible I've seen was for Saturday anyway, 118,000 people was their estimate for Saturday alone. So big, huge turnout.
That's about right, given what I've been through over the years. That seemed about. And the weather held out for pretty much the weekend. As I was driving out in the rain on Thursday, the forecast was rain all weekend. So the rain gods decided to disappear and we got a fairly decent show. And what I didn't get to do was I didn't get to watch Max and Lisa drool over the Raptor, but then again, I was on base when the F-35 was doing barrel rolls and touch and goes when nobody else was. So I'm not going to complain.
No. No, it was nice the next day. Monday morning, our hotel room, we were up on the fifth floor and it overlooked the runways. So we actually got to see the two F-22s leave. We got to see some of the Thunderbirds leave. Also, the hotel where Drone Mama and I were staying is also the hotel that where the Thunderbirds team was staying. Rather large team that travels with this. It's pretty impressive. And so we got to actually talk to and meet a couple of those folks. What a really nice bunch. So a big success all around. We're assembling some photos, and we'll announce where that is going to be sometime soon in the future. Meantime, Drone Mama took, she tells me, about 300 photos. Most of them she posted up on Instagram. So if you go to our Airplane Geeks Instagram page, you can find a lot of photos that she put up, and you can get a sense for it.
And if you look under David Vanderhoof, also my Instagram photos are up there from the show.
So. Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, and I think Carlos from Plane Talking UK is still editing his. He told me that he took over 1,200.
Wow. And hey, we got to hear Drone Mama on a very short podcast recently.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yes. Right. We had to skip the UAV Digest for last week. Was it last week? Last week. The week of the air show, because the schedules weren't going to allow it. So, yeah, she made the announcement. All right, we should press on. Let's see. What's going on? Rob, you've graduated your daughter from college. What else is happening in your life?
Well, funny story. She gets in the car after the event, because I had to drive around to pick her up and all that. And she gets in the car and says, "Dad, guess who I got an email from?" I said, "I don't know. Who?" She said, "The feds. They wanted to let me know that my 6-month grace period for my student loans had started ticking down." She must have had her diploma for 2 hours. So, I mean, wow. They're not kidding when they say they're after you for those student loans, man. I'll tell you.
No.
No, it was fun. It was pretty emotional. And you realize that they've gotten somewhere, and all you did was write the checks. They really had to do all the work. And so it was a lot of fun. But coming up, let's see, where I'm headed up to Canada tomorrow, up to going through Calgary and up to a place called Banff, where there's a national park, I guess.
Yeah, beautiful one.
And,
very gorgeous.
And a big ski area.
Oh, so you guys have been there?
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah.
Not,
so that means
not
one
yet.
Yeah, one no.
One, yeah. Mine is really not yet.
Well, it looks like it's going to be pretty interesting. So I'm taking the wife and daughter, and we're going to go goof off for 4 or 5 days just to kind of relax a little bit, I think. And then I'm, where am I headed? Oh, I'm going to Wichita. Go fly, do a little pilot report on the G-58 Baron, which nobody even knows anything about anymore. And then down to St. Martin in mid-June for a conference on Caribbean aviation. So that ought to be fun.
Great.
But that's about it from this end.
Cool. Max T., what's going on with you?
Oh, I just had to comment back to something Robin said earlier. You were talking about a Harrison Ford movie, and I thought for sure you were talking about Witness, the one down in Amish country, because I thought where you were going on that was that when all the cars are replaced by a hybrid electric aircraft, that only the Amish will be driving cars at that point in time.
Oh, now I,
don't
now
you hate
I get
that,
it.
Though, when you try to come up with a name and you can see it and you go, it's that movie with, you know, what's his name, when they were, you know, the... And you can see bits and pieces of it flashing by, and you realize you've made a complete fool of yourself because you can't remember the name. I guess there's a new Blade Runner, though, too.
Well, I think it's funny. We were both thinking of Harrison Ford movies at the same time. I guess there's a Harrison Ford movie for all circumstances.
Wow.
Yeah, get off my airplane.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. Well, let's see. What have I been up to? I just came back from a long weekend of teaching in Concord, California, in the Cirrus. So I did that 2 weeks ago in Knoxville, did that again for another Cirrus Owner Pilots Association, CPPP, the pilot proficiency program. So that was fun. And it looks like a couple of things came out of that. I'll probably be headed up to Utah to do training with a gentleman there that I haven't seen for a number of years that was down at that event. And looks like I'm going down to El Paso, Texas, potentially within a couple of weeks to pick up an airplane and bring that back. So, holy cow, I thought things were going to be nice and quiet, but looks like it's going to be busy again.
Wow. Wow, great.
Do you think there's a type rating in the Vision Jet in your future?
Anything is possible, but the particular path for that has not yet been identified. So anybody who's a position holder for the Vision Jet, give me a call.
All right. Brian, Micah, our main man, of course, was with us in Pittsburgh. It was always great to see Micah. But have you and he been doing something else together?
Yeah, I can't say we. So Micah was on a radio show, WBZ, which is a CBS station in Boston. And he was on the show with Bradley J talking airplanes. And Micah sends me a Skype message saying, hey, why don't you call in? And so I call into the show. And Bradley then invites me to stay for the rest of the show.
No
so
kidding.
We talked for about 45 minutes about aircraft and some commercial stuff, some military stuff, some drone stuff. It was a tremendous amount of fun, except it was between 3 and 4 a.m. So my morning this morning was a little bit rough.
I bet. Holy smokes.
But you said you were on a CBS station. That's not just a CBS station. That is the Voice of New England. That's a clear channel, 1030 BZ? I remember that very well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that...
Yes.
Now, radio, of course, is usually different from podcasting in that radio, once it's broadcast, it's kind of gone. Is there a recording of this conversation anywhere, do you know?
Yeah, so they take the show and turn it into a podcast, and in a few days when they finish it and publish it, maybe by the time we do the show notes, I'll actually have a URL for it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so the previous week's shows are on the website, but this particular episode hasn't been published yet, and I really want to thank Micah for allowing me to crash his party. It was a tremendous amount of fun, regardless of the hour.
If I got a phone call from Micah at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, hey, you want to join me on the radio? I'd just hang up. I'll be honest with you. I'd just hang up.
Well, it was a text message and I was awake. I had actually just finished the sound check with Matt. So.
Oh, dear. Oh, my.
All yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay,
it was,
good.
It was kind of crazy.
All right. A shout out. So we have coming up the Aerospace Media Dinner and Awards. And this is going to take place in Paris on June 18th of this year. They say the Aerospace Media Awards have been created to honor individuals and publishers who have made a significant contribution to aerospace publishing. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes, but I was sort of scrolling through the list of nominees, I guess you'd call them. And there were a few familiar names in there, including one, Rob Mark. Rob, have you been holding out on us?
Me? What? Yeah. No, I saw that. It was kind of nice to be nominated. We'll see. There's quite a few other good folks in that list, and I think it tells you that you're really getting old when you look at a nomination list like that and realize you must know at least half of the people on it. And I think they're all a bunch of really good writers. And I've won a couple, they've won a couple, and I don't think anybody thinks too much more about it than that until the actual night of the event. Then we all go, it's got to be me. It's got to be me. Unfortunately, I won't be in Paris, so I have a friend already that's going to be there. It just, you know, just in case.
Yeah. So you're nominated for Best Business Aviation Submission. This is an article, Alone in the Cockpit, right?
Yes, that's right. That was something that came out in Flying last year.
And also I see in there Tim Robinson. Of course, that name sounds familiar. Tim is on the Aviation Extended podcast. Tim is part of the Royal Aeronautical Society, and he's nominated for Best Military Aviation Submission. His article was A Game for Drones, Lessons from Unmanned Warrior. And then I also saw John Walton in there, Best Aerospace and Defense Business Submission.
Yeah.
Yeah, John's article was Airbus CEO Answers Lack of Senior Women and Ethnic Minorities. And that was an article he published in Mary Kirby's Runway Girl Network. So, and there were a bunch of other names, of course, I recognize in that list. So, again, a link to that in the show notes if you want to see who's on the list, see how many folks you know.
And do we get to vote?
You know, I tell you a funny story. This last week at our local airport, we gave a tour to a number of senior aviation officials from Iraq that came from Basra, from Baghdad, all kinds of, you know, obviously all men. We were touring one of the fixed base operators, and the manager was showing people around saying, this is the locker room for the guys, and this is the locker room for the ladies. And, you know, we'd certainly like to recruit more ladies into the business if we could. And one of the Iraqi guys in somewhat broken English says, why? and I thought, you know, right there, I mean, that's like such an incredible point of difference in cultures. And so we tried to explain why, but he just didn't get it.
So, Rob, do we get to vote? Because I want to stuff the ballot box there. I want to make sure you win.
I think the decision has already been made, I believe. Uh-huh.
But they do accept.
I'll have to try that next year.
They accept bribes, though, right? It can't be too late. They haven't presented.
No. Don't say that.
They know where I'm from. And of course, you know, large amounts of cash in brown paper bags is pretty typical,
especially when it's around voting time.
All right.
Absolutely. All right. You know, Chicago, vote. What is it? Vote
early.
Vote often.
All right. Hey, let's move on to some listener mail. We heard from Dave. Dave sent us an article. This is from, abc.net.au. Dave says, enjoy your show. Listen every week. Thought you might be interested in an aviation story from down under. Now, this is Qantas Chief Alan Joyce gets pie in face at Perth Business Breakfast. And it's... well, it's exactly what it sounds like. There's a video in this article. Joyce was addressing a group of people, about 500 people, at this Business Leadership Matters event at a hotel. He was the keynote speaker. He's standing at the podium giving his speech. Along walks a man in a suit. He's holding a pie in his hand, and he plants it firmly on Alan Joyce's face and then walks off the other side of the stage. So fairly humorous. You can certainly watch this video. I think it's good for a laugh. And thanks, Dave, for sending that in.
Yeah, it's humorous, unless if you were the one getting the pie in your face.
Well, I thought Joyce kind of reacted pretty well. I mean,
he did.
He did have to step off stage and get cleaned up a little bit because, well, he had a pie in his face and all over his suit. But he came back on and he did his thing. I guess they arrested the pie thrower, or the guy who pushed the pie into his face. Don't know the motivation for it. Although, you know, I guess you could, you know, imagine several motivations for it. But
come on, Alan Joyce, he's so well loved in Australia.
Yeah, I know. Maybe you Australian listeners can give us some more details or follow up on the story, the man with the pie. Who was that man? And then we have a couple of, well, they're kind of related emails. They're about aviation careers, kind of. And first one from Richard. He writes, first off, let me say, I love your podcast. It's very informative, entertaining, and inspiring for those such as myself. And I greatly enjoy your segments. He says, David is just wow. A human encyclopedia of aviation knowledge. I have a question that I'm hoping you can shed some light on, or maybe provide a different sense of perspective and maybe encouragement. So before I give the question that Richard sent, again, Richard, thanks for the compliments. Really, really appreciated. So Richard's question, he says, pertains to the potential privatization of the national airspace system and how it might be.
Huh? Can I just quickly chime in and say the best part of this was he flattered me and asked everybody else the question.
Yeah, because usually you get the question after the flattery. He writes, my question pertains to the potential privatization of the national airspace system and how it might be serving to dissuade prospective pilots from receiving flight training or obtaining a certificate. He says, I've always dreamed of learning to fly, but for a variety of reasons haven't been able to make it happen. We all know flying is not easy on the wallet, he says, but what about the other costs? My biggest concern, for example, is the danger of privatization and user fees in the system. I've listened to a variety of podcasts and sources that state that if user fees are introduced to the NAS, then GA will effectively be killed off. He writes, one of the reasons that I have not yet started is that thanks to my career, I would have to be a piecemeal student, effectively flying maybe twice a week, primarily on weekends, which would most likely necessitate using a Part 61 school to allow me to the necessary flexibility around work. I would hate to complete the process only to find out that I would have wasted an exorbitant amount of money on what essentially would be a piece of plastic. I know that AOPA is doing everything they can to prevent and dissuade the privatization aspect, but as we are all learning, with this current political environment, there are no guarantees and everything is subject to a whim, regardless of which political side of the fence one may fall on. Thus, my question is it worth it if one is not already involved in the aviation field? So what do you think? Rob, I know you gave Richard some feedback.
Well, I think what I gave him to think about was whether putting the ATC issue away, pretending as if it didn't exist, would he still want to learn to fly? And I think that that's probably the most important thing, because there have been times that I've certainly met people that said, oh, well, I'd learn to fly if it wasn't for, and then, you know, Max T's heard these as many as I did. You know, there's always something they fill in the blank with. But in the response I got back from Richard, in fact, it turns out he's a neighbor of mine, and I didn't even know that. He only lives about a mile away from me.
Oh, really?
He said, I actually did take a Discovery flight. And so I've already invited him to join our local airport flying club breakfast next month. And he's going to bring his wife out and just hang out and schmooze. And honestly, I think that's the best way, the best thing we can do for anyone that shows an interest is to show interest in them and encourage them and say, listen, if you want to do this, there's always a way somehow. And I think sometimes when people look at it, you know, not being directly involved with the industry all the time, they see a lot of roadblocks. And so I think that's the job of all of us. Hey, that's what we do here in general on the whole show is to try to eliminate some of those cobwebs for people so they can maybe see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, and some of those obstacles and roadblocks are real. I think that people, you know, do have real issues that may hold them up from starting to fly. But I think the difference is, I did a survey for a large group of people a while back and surveyed both people who completed their license and people who didn't complete their license. The amazing thing was they all cited the same obstacle. The difference was the people who got their license found a way to get around those obstacles. So I think that's important, is, you know, to realize, no, it's not that it's easy for some people. It's work, and there are challenges for everybody. You just have to decide, do you want to do it?
We also received an email from Nikki. And Nikki says, I've been listening for a short time and was wondering if you could give me some advice. She says, I'm not looking for a yes or no, just some friendly advice or input from the team. So Nikki writes, I'm in my late 30s and live in the Central Florida region. I was thinking about making a possible career change into flying. I've always enjoyed flying, and in college, my friends used to take me up and let me fly the plane for fun once we were at flight level. At the time, I could not afford flying lessons, and even now it would be a stretch. But if you want to do something, anything is possible. So my question is, would it even be feasible to get a piloting job at or around 40 for a female? And do you have any recommendations for someone looking for a flight school or instructor? Any additional advice or input would be greatly appreciated. So, Max T, how would you respond to Nikki?
Boy, I think it was said best by our guest, Terry Gallo, Vice President of Flight Operations for SkyWest, when we had him on here sometime last year. And he said there has never been a better time in history to become an airline pilot. So I would say, yeah, the opportunities are definitely there. I'd probably be telling you something different if you said you were 55 or 60. I think that would be a little bit more of a challenge, simply because I have a feeling that airlines are probably less likely to put somebody into the right seat who's 20 years older than the person in the left seat. Not that they couldn't, but I think they might be a little bit more reluctant to do that. But I would say, yeah, go for it. I think if you do this, you will find the jobs are available.
Oh, yeah. I agree with Max T. I mean, the industry is short of pilots now, and it's going to be even more short of pilots in the next 5 years. And so you can't wait until the need becomes critical to start, because it takes time to become experienced enough to get out almost any kind of flying job, really. And so if you have the interest and you can make the resources available somehow, yeah, go for it.
All right. One final piece of listener feedback, and this is from Ken. If unless there are some radial engine experts here on the call, maybe this will be more a request for help from all of you listening who are familiar with radial engines. But Ken writes, first of all, I love your podcast. Please keep it coming. I was listening to a discussion on another podcast, that was UCAP, that was about 4 years old, and someone asked the question if any piston engine can be hand-propped. This reminded me of a book I read called The Golden Years of Flying. As we remember, Frontier Airlines 1946 to 1986 by Captain Tex Searle. In this book, he writes, which is a collection of stories from retired pilots, there is one pilot saying he watched a very large person hand prop and start a DC-3. That seemed a little hard for me to believe. What do you guys think? Should we submit this to Mythbusters? Second question. I recently watched The Great Waldo Pepper, and in the movie, the Jenny is hand-propped by throwing the prop in the wrong direction. The prop then stops and kicks back, and the engine runs. I thought it was a Hollywood mistake the first time I saw it, but then Pepper does it a couple more times in the movie. Why is this done to start that plane? What's different from, say, a Cub or Champ that I'm more familiar with? So,
hey Max, how did you start your radio controlled airplanes?
The spring,
by hand propping them and reverse propping them, and having propped DC-3s and B-25s, they're just like everything else. Now the B-25, it took about four of us to prop it, but the DC-3 I've seen propped by a single person, just takes longer.
Huh. I didn't realize we had some local experience with this. All right, David.
David's a lot older than he looks.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a reason we call him One-Arm David.
Yeah. What? Oh, God.
But you know, volunteered at the museum, we had a B-25, we had an R-4D, and when we do air shows, you prop the engines.
Okay, this is going to sound really stupid, David, but why didn't they just start it with the electric starter?
Because you got to get the oil to balance through the engine.
Wait a minute. So we're not talking about the same thing. I understood the concept of you know, spinning the propeller to, you know, people told me that the oil needed to be moved around the cylinders and things, but they weren't actually throwing the mags on and trying to get the airplane engine to fire that way, were they?
Oh, no. Then I misunderstood the question.
See that?
All right.
Okay. Now it makes more sense to me, because I thought, I can't believe anybody's going to get that old, what was that, a Wright engine, I think, in some of the early DC-3s?
In the early DC-3s, yeah, later Pratt & Whitney, but the early ones were Wright.
I just couldn't believe they were going to get the damn thing to fire with anybody pulling that thing through. So, okay. Now it makes more
sense. The oil would pool, and you need those things are very leaky when it comes to oil for reasons that were valid at the time.
There's nothing worse than standing static display at an air show next to a radial engine. because 9 times out of 10, at least 100 times a day, somebody will walk up with a lit cigarette and look into the engine. And you have to politely say, sir, I don't like blowing up. Could you walk away, please? This is loaded with fuel.
Well, we should just add that one should never prop an aircraft unless they have been trained by someone who knows what they're doing, because obviously you can get killed pretty quickly and efficiently by hand propping an airplane incorrectly.
Oh, no, you can't. Only if you don't get out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. There is that.
Trust me. All it takes is if you've been a radio controlled airplane flyer, it only takes once to getting snapped by a prop that you learn really quickly. That's why you get the guns that prop the engine and not do it yourself.
And I've even seen radio control flyers who are missing, you know, tips of fingers and stuff like that. Yeah. So even that can be pretty nasty.
All right, let's wrap this one up. I want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest again was Matt Knapp, one of the founders of Zunum Aero. You can find them at zunum.aero, at Z-U-N-U-M. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. As always, show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/453. If you go there, you'll find all the places you can locate us on social media, how to send us email feedback, and all of that. There's also a donate button on the webpage. So if you'd like to help finance this little operation, that would be greatly appreciated. Just click that donate button. And if you're able to give us a few dollars, whatever you can afford, that would be terrific. Let's tell people where they can find us online. Rob Mark, start with you.
Well, they can find me and my cohort, Scott Spangler, any place that Jetwine has fallen into the name there somewhere, but certainly up at flyingmag.com and Flying Magazine on Facebook and within the pages of Flying Magazine.
Great. Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, they can find me on the flight line at the Palo Alto Airport. If you're out this way and you want to go flying, give me a call. You can find my GA Flying website, sjflight.com, short for San Jose, and contact me through that.
And Aviation News Talk podcast.
There is that new podcast, which has been a whole lot of fun. Yes, aviationnewstalk.com.
Hey, Max, what's the name of your new podcast?
it's called The Rob and Max Show, and you're going to be responsible for the next episode.
Oh man, you've been cranking out episodes pretty well there, Mr. T.
Well, I've determined one doesn't actually have to sleep.
Yeah, but they're really good. I've been really GA has never been so interesting actually. But
thanks.
That's true. All right, Brian Coleman.
He's right, Max. Don't. He's not joking. I actually like it too. It's kind of frightening.
Yeah. All right, Brian, how do folks reach you?
Oh, oddly enough, they're not going to find me at an airport. I have no travel planned between now and my trip to South Africa.
Yeah. That means tomorrow he's going to be on an airplane.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks, David. I appreciate that. Now, the best place to get a hold of me these days is brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
If you want to see pictures from Pittsburgh, I would suggest going to my Instagram account, which is David_Vanderhoof. If you can spell Vanderhoof, you can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And of course you can find me with that other guy, Max Flight, on Friday mornings on the UAV Digest, talking about hand propping drones.
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. David said at the UAVDigest.com, also at PAXXPodcast.com, that's PAXEXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby, and also at the Airplane Geeks Slack team. If you want to learn more about that, visit airplanegeeks.com/team. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find his compositions at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
Rob, we can see you, but we can't hear you.
And you're complaining? I mean, really?
Oh, wow.
He's there. Come on, Rob.
He's running between I am. But you're on mute.
Or Skype changed the microphone input.
Probably what it was. Oh, he probably updated too. His app.
I can hear you and I'm not on mute.
Well, Rob, you should talk in that case.
Check your mic settings.
Yeah, check your mic settings. Make sure it...
This is great. So we can just talk about him. Then I get that.
Yeah, sounds like he's fair game at this point. Sure.
Exactly.
Hello?
Ah, you're there.
Hey, Rob.
It works.
Good.
Oh, boy, darn, I don't know what that was. Of him anymore.
Yeah.
Hi, sorry about that. Hi, guys. I could hear you just dandy before, and I kept saying, come on. You guys are doing this to me. I know you can hear me, and of course that, I guess you.
That couldn't. Would have been good. No,
we're not that creative, Rob.
Or coordinated.
Now that probably you said so. That, we're going to try that in the future one day. We're all going to do that.
Uh huh. Okay. Thank you. Just keep one thing in mind, Matt. Don't use a lot of big words.
Okay.
No. Why would you say that?
Yeah. Really.
Because we don't do well with big words.
But our listeners,
hybrid electric propulsion is pretty much my entire.
Oh yeah, see, he's already starting. Oh my gosh!
So, despite what Rob says, generally just don't listen to what Rob says.
but wait a minute. What is the popular press? According to sources in Washington, no one in the press is popular.
Yep. Uh huh. Yep.
It's the failing newspaper and the unfair press, I think is what we call it now.
There you go.
And so this will be all fake news tonight.
The fake news. Okay, we can do that.
Cool.
David brought pizzas. How many pizzas did you buy? About eight?
Six.
Six? Six giant pizzas. And it was fantastic. It's like he said, it was outside. It was dark, getting dark. It was getting cold. It was
damp.
Everybody
had been drinking.
Everybody been drinking. The Brits, God, those guys drink like fishes.
Brian is pretty much on par with everybody else.
Well, yeah, Brian puts away a few as well.
Yeah, par, I was leading the way. Come on.
You're under par.
That's true. Hey,
so the National Guard had the Raptors. I would have thought that those would be mostly with Air Force units and that, you know, National Guard tends to get hand-me-downs. How do they end up with Raptors at the National Guard so soon in their, you know, deployment?
They're a co-located facility. What happened was for Virginia at Langley, there was the two squadrons, and then the Langley Air National Guard up in Richmond flew F-16s, originally A-7s, then flew F-16s. They got rid of the F-16s and then they brought them down to Langley and had them fly Raptors. They don't really own any aircraft. They're co-located, meaning their pilots fly the active duty squadron aircraft. If you ever look at something like a C-130 or a C-5, and there's two squadrons on the front of the aircraft, Dover does this with their C-17s. And their C-5s. They have an Air Force Reserve unit and an active duty unit, and they share aircraft.
I see.
And you asked, so I gave you the answer.
No, I was curious. So that was a great answer. Thanks.
Yeah, no, it was. It was just an amazing weekend. You know, the show, the listeners.
Captain Rick was awesome.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
And Max, I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, when the guy walks up to you in dinner on Thursday night, hasn't ever met you before, and you look at him and go, I want that patch, and he goes, take it off my shoulder, you got to admit the guy's nice.
Yeah.
I got my 9/11 wing patch from him, for literally off his face.
Yeah, he literally took the patch off of his uniform, gave it to David. Wow, you know?